tolerable after he read the long article I wrote analyzing his views, which was entitled More Heat and Some Light on the Spanish Conquest of America. Be that as it may, Don Ramon was the greatest authority in Spain. And his attack, in most respects, was the most sophisticated, the most documented attack on Las Casas, 1962. So I was surprised that the Dominican Order put him up for beatification and canonization, and Spain itself. In February, just last month, I was happy to be present in Madrid at a meeting organized by the cultural section of the present socialist government. They too wanted to honor Las Casas. However, I noticed they didn't permit any Dominican to speak. In Mexico, in October, where they had another meeting, they did have a Dominican speak, but not in Spain. However, it goes on. They recognize Las Casas, although the story has not been ended. I still remember in 1932 when I went to Spain to work on Las Casas, my good friend Earl J. Hamilton, a great economic historian who wrote a classic work on the effect of the Spanish conquest on the rise of prices in Europe. He said, Hanky, what are you doing working on Las Casas? When are you going to work on some important topic? Well, I was shaken a little bit. And I wrote to Ludwig Fandel, the great German scholar in the Golden Age studies. He wrote back also and said, well, we know all we need to know about Las Casas. All his publications have been known. Why bother? And then I wrote to Emilio Ravignani, the Argentine, who had brought out a few years before a facsimile edition of his 1552 treatises. And Ravignani said, no, we all have a superficial knowledge of Las Casas, but his truth, his basic ideas have not yet been fully understood. He encouraged me. I followed that address, which of course that advice, which I supported, and that began my interest until today. I still think it's a good topic for discussion, and I believe that the Spaniards will be useful as a historical background. I was trying to think whether there's any Spanish background for this present discussion. I don't think there is. I believe that the Alaska Native Review Commission is making history. And I'm glad to hear that the documentation of these proceedings, these many discussions in the field, these various roundtables are going to be preserved at the University of Alaska, so they'll be useful for scholars in the future. Because this struggle has been long, it is not ended. And perhaps in 1992, right after that famous 1991 date, which has been mentioned, in 1992, when the world will be studying the first 500 years of the discovery of America, all kinds of curious things will be done. I think there are many government commissions already set up, and I imagine there are going to be many banquets, medals struck off, political figures can go by first class air to various meetings to discuss well-known subjects. But I hope that in 1992, one of the important, one of the basic topics will be the history of the native peoples of the Americas, from Alaska to Patagonia. And I'm sure that the proceedings of Judge Berger's activities will be one of the important, indeed indispensable parts of that record. I thought just of one possible predecessor, not really, but it should be mentioned. In the early 16th century in the Caribbean, there was some Spanish government official with a sociological orientation who decided to determine whether the Indians could learn to live like Spanish Christians of Castile, Spanish laborers from Castile. Of course, the natives always had to measure up to our standards. And so they had a Control Village, and gave this Control Village, this is the 1520s, 1530s, spades and seeds and stuff like that. And then another village didn't get them at all. After a certain period, the inspector, there was a Spanish inspector who made reports, I presume, in triplicate, he went around and talked to the natives about their experiences. And he found, his standards evidently very high, he found only one Indian man whom he felt had measured up to these splendid criteria for to be a Spanish laborer in Castile, and he offered to the Indian. When the Indian found, however, that his wife was not really in this sacred group, he disappeared. Another very curious thing I should mention this, the Indians also had interesting ideas about the Spaniards. We don't have that history of America yet. There's a group of Enrique Dussel and other religious historians who are writing history of Latin America from the standpoint of the poor. They've already started. I think it's a 20-volume thing. But you do not have very many Indian voices. That's why I think the documentation which is being assembled now in Alaska is going to be of such great importance, because for the first time there is the documentation from the native groups and native individuals. But there's one case where the Indians did wonder about those Spaniards. This was early 16th century, about 1510 in Puerto Rico. It's a famous aspect of Puerto Rican history. If you want to surprise a Puerto Rican, tell him you know all about that. These Indians thought that the Spaniards were immortal, or they wondered whether they could ever be killed. They didn't want really to declare war on them until they knew. So they took one Spaniard around the corner and ducked him in a river until he was dead. And then they hauled the lifeless body to the shore, laughing and explaining. It was just a sort of a joke. They didn't really know. Until they waited 3 days before the body, and then, realizing that he was in truth dead, declared war against the Spaniards. Well, to conclude, you have my thoughts in this paper. Think of them as topics which may be worthy of discussion. There are many other topics worthy of discussion, but these are ones which occurred to me. And remember, I am a retired professor living in Amherst, Massachusetts, a small town, and this is my first visit to Alaska. Be kind.
Well, thank you, Professor Henke. I think that that your reference to 1992 is apposite, because 1992 is not only the year in which there will be celebrations of the 500th anniversary of Columbus' landfall in the West Indies, but the way in which ANCSA is structured, January 1st, 1992, is the day on which the shares actually can be bought and sold. The shares will be called back in 1991, but it isn't until January 1st, 1992 that the shares go on the market. So there is a juxtaposition of events that makes your remarks about the conquest, I think, quite apposite.
May I add one thing about Las Casas? He's the only man in history that I know who's had the 500th anniversary of his birth celebrated twice. When I was young, we thought that he was born in 1474. We had no certificate, but that was the consecrated date. And indeed, in 1974, I remember going to Mexico to celebrate at the expense of the Mexican government this important anniversary. And they took us down to San Cristobal de las Casas, that part of southern Mexico where Las Casas was bishop in the 16th century. As a matter of fact, his doctrines were so hated by the Spanish colonists, he was chased out of his bishopric. But then a few years after 1974, an American woman researcher found in that great Archivo General de Indias in Sevilla a document which seems to prove, and I think does prove, that he was born in 1484, not 74. Well, now they're all cranked up again in the world to have these meetings. Mexico, last October, I've mentioned the Dominican meeting in Berkeley in January of this year, the meeting last year in Toulouse, France, a two-day meeting in November. There was a meeting in Madrid 3 days last month. They're also having a meeting in Rome. So I think we have another rather distinction for Las Casas. There's no other person in history that I know of who's had his 500th anniversary of birth celebrated twice.
Well, I intend to call on some of the intellectuales opposite, but before I do that, maybe we could... Bishop DeRue, I'm curious whether you would like to follow Professor Hanke and make some observations on...
No, only that I was a student of the Dominicans for a couple of years, that's all.
Anyone like to make any comments or ask any questions of Professor Hanke? Doug Sanders.
This is irresistible. There are a couple of questions that I would like to ask you, and I'm not sure there's anyone else on earth I could ask them of. One has interested me for quite a while. Felix Cohen, who was the legal advisor to the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the Indian New Deal period in the 1930s, wrote an article called The Spanish Origins of Indian Rights in the United States, in which he put forward a proposition that the early recognition by Spain of indigenous rights, mixed though it was a precursor to recognition in the United States. I wondered if you had comments on this. One of the interesting aspects is that it seems to me that certainly in United States law, the beginning point is seen to be the judgments of Chief Justice Marshall that Judge Berger referred to in his opening remarks. And one of the interesting things about Marshall's judgments, which, as was indicated, purport to be based on international law, is the fact that Marshall doesn't cite anything at all. He appears simply to make it all up. It stood for a long time, so it was rather good. But in terms of the linkage that Cohen later asserted, one cannot find it explicitly in the Marshall judgments. And so it seemed to me that Cohen perhaps was putting forward an attempt at linkage which perhaps could not be sustained. And I wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, I happened to read that article during the last year just by chance and was not particularly impressed by it or by his knowledge of the whole Spanish ambiente. I don't think he gave very much attention to Francisco de Vitoria and the other Salamanca thinkers, because back of Las Casas were the solid thinkers of the 16th century. And was a great nation of theologians and political thinkers. And in Salamanca particularly, Francisco de Vitoria was the outstanding fellow. He was not an activist like Las Casas. He stayed all the time in his San Esteban monastery. But he had many students at Salamanca. And Salamanca, you may remember, in the 16th century was really probably superior even to Paris or Oxford in terms of forming theologians and political thinkers. So that I saw this article by Cohen. I must confess I didn't read it very carefully because I didn't think he had the necessary documentation. You know, historians love documentation. When I saw that he skipped around from one thing to another, I thought, well, you know, it's all right, I'm glad he's writing about it, but I didn't feel any need to analyze it carefully. I hope I am fair to Mr. Cohen. I didn't feel that he had a solid background with Spanish law. Now, we talk a great deal about Las Casas, and rightly so, but we must remember that he was only one of a number of thinkers in the 16th century. He was not even the one who first fought for justice or made sermons for justice. I've mentioned Antonio de Montesinos, 1511. But there were so many thinkers in 16th century Spain. I ran across so many treatises unpublished. I'd gone to Spain in 32 to look for Las Casas' papers and treatises. He had two cells. He was so old and venerable, he had two cells in Valladolid. And they say that these two cells are so full of papers and documents you could hardly get in or get out. I couldn't find those papers. I was discouraged. And then as I went around and talked to Spanish historians and political thinkers like Rafael Altamira, who had been a member of the International Court of The Hague, Fernando de los Rios, the philosopher who was later the Republic's ambassador in Washington, they said, don't bother about that. Las Casas was great, but there were many others. And so I began to look for other treatises and found, as a matter of fact, a whole volume finally came out in 1943 in the war in Mexico. Apparently nobody knows it today. Anyway, they're all unpublished treatises. And I found a number of unpublished treatises, which references to them, I couldn't find the text of them. So I had a bibliography of them year by year. And it was a tremendous accumulation. And therefore, anyone who wants to study and analyze the results of, or the influence of, Las Casas or Spanish thinkers on later legal questions must be conversant, in my opinion, with the legal developments in Spain. There are all kinds of things. Let me just mention one. The Jesuits were never very much interested in Las Casas and these ideas. The Jesuits have their own way of life, their own intellectual world. Independent, great scholars they are. Anyone who reads a Jesuit must be careful to use his documentation carefully. But there was one, Alonso Sanchez, in Manila, because these struggles were in the Philippines as well as in Americas. Alonso Sanchez in the 1580s ran across the citizens of the inhabitants of Manila, the Philippine Islands. They were Muslims. Ah, he said, these are representatives of the ancient enemies of Spain in the Middle Ages. And so his treatises, he declared war by fire and sword, this Jesuit, against the natives of the Philippines, because of Spanish medieval history, you might say. But anyway, getting back to your main point, I think that Spanish legal bibliography is not as well known in the West as it should be. I remember the course I took under Professor McElwain at Harvard on the political ideas, political theory from Aristotle Rousseau. When I proposed Las Casas to him, he'd never heard of Las Casas. But he said, well, go ahead and do what you can, so to speak. The people, he knew French legal theory, British legal theory, something about Italy. But Spain and even Portugal, they're different. That's why the historical experience of Spain, the legal precedents and legal subtleties and philosophical approaches are, I think, basic to this question.
Are you aware of analogies or drawing on the history of Vitoria and Las Casas in the United States in the context of Indian policy before the New Deal? Because in the New Deal period, two figures in print do this, Cohen and
Collier,
and Collier himself, who it may be Collier had, of course, an interest in the Americas, and he may well be the key to this intellectual connection, picking it up from Central and South America, where Las Casas's memory would have been vivid, although he was not known, as you've very well pointed out. But I wondered if there was any other source in which this had been brought up in the United States that you were aware of before that period.
I don't recall ever having seen anything of that, but I do remember that as one studies the collections in the United States on Spain and Spanish America, the great collections in the John Carter Brown Library of Brown University, the New York Public Library, Widener Library at Harvard, the Bancroft Library in Berkeley, they're full of this treatise denouncing the cruelty of the Spaniards to the Indians. Or they're full of these wonderful translations into English, French, Dutch, Flemish, Latin, German, again with these illustrations, so that their perception of Spain was cruelty. As a matter of fact, if you rub most Americans, even today, I think you were Spain, backward and cruel. I hope that generalization can be supported. But I think that you'll find that there's a deep feeling in the Anglo-Saxon, at least Protestant, tradition that that Spain is a kind of a backward nation. I think maybe that's rubbed off our attitude toward Latin America. We know what the Nicaraguans should do. We know how Brazil ought to conduct its economic affairs and other affairs. It's kind of a putting down, and that reminds me of Las Casas, perhaps his greatest contribution I have not mentioned. His phrase, all the peoples of the world are men. His feeling that all peoples could be educated, they had potential for education, that was entirely alien from most people, and even some people today. Likewise, the Spaniards were the first to study other peoples. So far as I know, there was nothing before the 16th century of one nation studying another. Did the Romans study Greek culture and Greeks? I doubt it. Literature, yes. Herodotus, we're told, traveled, the great first historian, traveled around the Mediterranean looking at people, but it was a kind of a miscellaneous observance. I remember his famous phrase pointed out that in Greece, the men went to the marketplace and the women stayed at home weaving. Whereas he said, it's just the opposite in Egypt. There, the women go to the marketplace and the men stay at home weaving. Things like that. But the first time that any people was studied, so far as I know, anthropologically, was by Bernardino de Sahagún, a Spaniard in Mexico. About 1560, he was given the opportunity or the order by his provincial to study the culture of the Indians. Why? So they could Christianize them more efficiently and find out what devils animated them. And this man had a village. He had three or four Indians, taught them Latin, and systematically studied their cultural elements, the anthropologist would say today. But being an anthropologist, and historians too are always skeptical of things like that, he moved to another village with different informants to make sure that he was getting the truth. Then he finished it all up center of Spain and was lost for two centuries. But it's the first great anthropological work in the world, so far as I know. And he, in some time in his 10 years of study, he was transformed from being a Franciscan thinking about converting these Indians, and he became a professional scholar anthropologist. He was interested in their customs, even things which, well, for example, he has this famous chapter on the 12 ways in which the Indians got ceremonially drunk, intoxicated. Well, his Franciscan brother thought that was not quite the kind of study that a Franciscan should be engaged in. And he said, well, of course, like a doctor must study disease. Naturally, we who wish to cure the souls of these poor folk, we have to know everything about them, including the 12 ways in which they got ceremonially intoxicated. But in any case, that's another first for the Spaniards, and I believe that another thing we will never forget about Las Casas, whether we follow him in all his respects or not, we must remember that he said all the peoples of the world are men. They have a right to their own culture. It should be studied. I think Reverend Jesse Jackson is trying to say the same thing in the last political campaign. We are somebody. Reverend Jackson said, we are somebody. That's what the Franciscans and other Spaniards who studied the Indian in the 16th century helped their somebody. And I think that's a lesson we still have. I don't know whether we learn enough about other cultures in our schools. I'm sure that in some countries of the world, they portray us in very special ways, you know, generalizations about us. But if you are going to try to understand other cultures and other ways of thinking, how can you do it except by studying them? That's one of the great contributions of Las Casas, which I still think is pertinent.
If I can pursue this, if I can pursue this, it seems to me that there are two elements of the Spanish traditions which have been picked up over the last 50 or 60 years and used in certain kinds of ways, and one of them is the traditions of Las Casas and Vitoria in terms of the conceptualizations that were involved. And you might be interested that a scholar from Sweden analyzing the Swedish situation in terms of the Sami linked back some an intellectual tradition through the international lawyers to Vitoria to a Danish jurist who had accepted the proposition of the territorial rights of the Sami or Lapp people in the middle of the 18th century.
What year did the Danish writer write? In what year?
1752 was the product, which is the Treaty of Stamstead, defining the border between Norway and Sweden.
But the Danish writer you referred to was of that period?
Yes, Stampe. Uh-huh. But the other element of the So the use of Vitoria is both credited in the United States in the 30s and as having had influence in Scandinavia in terms of Sami land rights in the middle 18th century. But the second element of the Spanish tradition is the establishment of the reducciones, or the reductions. And it seemed to me that there's been some influence. The Jesuits in New France were responsible for the first establishment of reserves or reservations in what is now Canada. And the Jesuits wrote that the model that they were following was a model from Mexico and Paraguay. They held out some utopian hopes for the reserves that they were establishing. And when Collier was involved with the New Deal reforms in the 1930s in the United States, he also refers to the reducciones in the positive utopian myth about them. My question really is, what do you have any sense of the continuing impact of the idea of the reducciones in Central and South America? It seems to me in North America that they are invoked on these two occasions. I'm not sure of any others. It appears to me that it's regarded in Central and South America as a closed historical chapter, and that there's no reference back. Now, this may be outside of the field that you've worked in, but I wondered if you had any thought of the continuing of the intellectual impact, I suppose, of those developments which were very early in Spanish colonialism in Central and South America.
Well, we must go back to Las Casas here, too. In the 1540s, late 1530s, in Chiapas, southern Mexico now, Las Casas and other Dominicans established what they called La Tierra de la Vera Paz, the land of true peace. There, they kept the other Spaniards out and the Dominicans in. And the idea was that freed from the exactions and cruelties of the Spanish seculars, taken care of by the Dominican monks, they would be able to be protected and developed. That was a fracaso.
Native people.
Yes, that was a fracaso, because ideas came in, people came in, and eventually it led to deaths by Indians or Spaniards and vice versa. So that, the land of true peace. Las Casas still believed in peaceful persuasion, but reductions, no. I don't think he ever proposed that after this was a failure. Now, the Jesuit reductions, there's a great literature on that. As a matter of fact, Alfred Knopp brought out a very instrumental volume done by the Swedish scholar Magnus Myrner on the Jesuit reductions. And they, it was a sort of a dead duck. There wasn't anyone to go back to. They were kept apart. They were told whom to marry, when to have sexual relations. All these things. And so far as I know, there is no continuation of the idea of reductions. But going back to international law, the first person in the United States, at least, that I know who was concerned with this was James Brown Scott, the Secretary of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He had been to Salamanca, and he had a whole book on the Spanish origin of international law about 1932. It was James Brown Scott to whom I applied for money in 1942 to get my whole volume of unpublished treatises by Spaniards of the 16th century on these questions. He put the money, a modest amount, to bring it out in Mexico. And I think James Brown Scott was perhaps our outstanding scholar in the field of international law, who had a knowledge of and respect for the Spanish intellectual origins of international law, not just Vitoria, but other people too. But he did go to Salamanca. He did have this large volume published in handsome format by the Carnegie Endowment when they were flush. And through that one volume, I think, had a considerable influence on our, I don't know what his influence on Collier, but on international lawyers, I think, it was there.
Might I intervene for a moment? Hugh Brody had a question, I think, and then Sandy Davis, and then Orrin Young. And after these questions to Professor Henke, I wonder, Sandy, if I might call on you to follow Professor Henke, because we've been talking about the Spanish in Latin America and the work of Las Casas and so on, and I know that you're well acquainted with what's happening in Latin America. Sandy Davis is the author of Victims of the Miracle, about the condition of the native peoples of Brazil, and now heads the Anthropological Resources Center, which has many projects in Latin America. And it may be that after completed our questioning of Professor Henke, you might just follow on and tell us, well, what has happened to these great principles of Las Casas in Latin America and South America? What is the condition of native people? What about self-determination and the land base? The Pope has just returned from there. What about his views regarding their rights to self-determination and a land base? How are those exemplified in the regimes of Latin America today? So maybe we could go to Hugh, and then Sandy, and then David Case.
Your last thoughts are close to my question, Tom. It's important, and of course it's extremely exhilarating, to sense the analogy between what Las Casas and company were doing in 1550 and what many of us have been doing for the last 10 years or 15 years. And I suppose that there is a way in which we can excavate our own intellectual and moral meanings by a consideration of the 1550s. But nonetheless, there's something disquieting for me, and I perhaps for others, in this project, this search for analogies. And actually, what's disquieting, it strikes me, is the possibility of another kind of analogy, namely that while Las Casas was drawing attention to moral, legal, and anthropological truths, drawing attention to appalling injustice, the conquistadores and their friends marched on untouched. And what I want to hear you say something about, if you will, is whether or not, in your view, Las Casas and his moment in time that is to say, his view of what was happening at his moment in time, had any effect at all, any positive effect at all, on the pace and nature of the brutalization of the native peoples of South America.
I detect a certain note of skepticism here.
Disquiet.
Well, it's a good question, and it's difficult, if not impossible, to answer. However, one of the characteristics of Las Casas was that he had many supporters at the time. Many people wrote to him giving information on what was happening in America. And he had his own disciples. I was trying to think of influence even after he was dead. There were a number of important disciples worked and struggled, because this was a struggle that went on. Domingo de Santo Tomas, for example, in present-day Bolivia in the late 16th century, he was a Las Casista and tried to put it into effect. And you'd have to study very, it's really a study of the whole Spanish conquest to find out how far these ideas permeated. There was also Juan del Valle, a bishop in present-day Colombia. And all over the New World, there were disciples of Las Casas who struggled. Whether they were successful or not, we don't know. We do know that after this great debate, the issues were so complex, the problems were so sensitive, that they were never able to get the commission to vote, all of them to vote. There was never any decisive vote one way or the other. And we do know that shortly after the junta stopped, and they stopped talking Sepulveda and Las Casas, that the conquest was renewed. You know, it was stopped by a formal order while these fellows discussed. And after it was again continued. So the conquest did continue. How much influence? Well, some of those persons in Spain would answer by saying, look at the Spanish legislation, the great Recopilación de las Leyes de Indias. There is no other legislation by any colonizing power which has attempted to put into law, into legal precepts, many of the things that Las Casas stood for. Were they obeyed? Well, there we come to law even today, you know. How far is a given law obeyed? But there was an attempt there. Another thing, the Portuguese, although, of course, Catholic, lived in the same Iberian Peninsula as the Spaniards, and subject to the same historical influences. They were also invaded by the Muslims, and for centuries under Muslim portions of Spain. The Portuguese never developed any treatise writers, any political thinkers who discussed these questions of justice as Las Casas and many other Spaniards in the 16th century. I looked for them in Portugal. I made a special trip to Portugal once to try to find them. No, couldn't find them. Nor did they develop in Brazil any particular Indian defender. There was one in the 17th century, Antonio Vieira, who tried to protect the Indians in the Amazon region, but it was a small thing, small potatoes. The only laws protecting the Indians in Brazil were laws made by the Spanish king, Philip II, when Brazil was under Spain. Then they had laws protecting the Indians in the official legislation on Brazil. Now, if you ask, what good did it do? How far were the laws obeyed, actually? How can one answer that question? It's almost impossible to give any documentary proof or evidence which would convince a person.
Are there any reasons for thinking, to your knowledge, that the Indian people themselves derived comfort and strength from their knowledge of the debate that was taking place?
Ah, you're asking another one of those generalizations. Indians from the Yaquis in Mexico down to the Patagonians. How can I answer that?
Is there any evidence at all to suggest?
Well, I detect that skeptical tone. Any evidence at all? Well, No, I just think it's impossible to answer your question to your satisfaction, because it would involve a great knowledge, tremendous knowledge of history. And we know that many Indians were killed. Many Indians lost their lives because of disease or mistreatment or something. A lot of them are left. And that, of course, that's what the Spaniards say to us. Ah, we may have been cruel to our Indians, but we got a lot of Indians left. What do you do with your Indians? You put them in reservations and et cetera. No, that question is one of those questions that I'm afraid is not possible of any useful response, at least by me.
Sandy, and then Orin, and then David had questions, and then we'll turn back to Sandy for...
Maybe I'll leave my comments there.
Okay. Orin? Orin Young?
My question to Professor Hanke was a much more contemporary question, if he is willing to address issues of the present day as well as the 16th century. Toward the end of his paper that we have all read, he quotes a, to my mind, very interesting comment from Vine Deloria. On page 21, he says that in quoting Deloria, to the effect that accommodation need not mean assimilation, but then also to the effect that failure to make unavoidable accommodations with the majority may mean simply assimilation into the bottom of the social pyramid, and so on. And then in his own words, he says, to my mind, the term accommodation offers the most intelligent and hopeful direction in which to go. And I guess my question is, I was wondering if he would be willing to expand a little bit on, or to unpack a little bit, the content of the notion of accommodation, and also if Professor Hanke has any ideas of his own about what accommodations might be unavoidable and which accommodations might be something other than unavoidable accommodations.
I'm sorry I put that question, that statement in now, because I can't really give any useful answer either on that. There are so many different possible kinds of accommodations. I think what I was trying to, what I do feel is, I don't see how they can be sovereign in the independent sense. I'm not even quite sure of what the special interest, what the content there is. And I hope that we get sometime someone to explain what the special position is. But trying accommodation would not vary from almost from group to group, or I don't know. I'd like to, I wish Deloria would answer this question. He's the man who inspired me to put it down, and all I can say is I think it's one of those things that perhaps I shouldn't have put down, because I wasn't trying to give my own opinion. In my paper, I really didn't think I had a right to give an opinion on these many difficult questions, and the matters of accommodation, they must be settled, must they not, to a considerable extent by the people themselves. How can one speak for the various kinds of Native peoples in the Americas? I can't.
Just one follow-up on that. Toward the end of his comments, Tom spoke about a special place for indigenous peoples unlike that of any other minority. Is it your vision of accommodation that would be compatible with Tom Berger's special place, or would this again be something that would be determined on a case-by-case basis by different groups and different places within the Americas?
Well, as you know from my paper, I'm impressed by the role of immigration in the United States. There are 1,000 refugees from Laos in Rockford, Illinois. Has anybody been in Rockford, Illinois? 1,000 from Laos. Since 1975, some 750,000 refugees, immigrants have come from Southeast Asia. Millions pass over our southern border from Mexico, from Central America, from Colombia. I don't know. I just don't see how a Congress, a nation looking at these problems, I just don't see how a special place which is immutable and always there for a much smaller group of people, unless we are going to somehow or other diminish our commitments elsewhere. Maybe we should. But I confess I have been, when I sat down to think about it, since the time my grandfather came here from Germany, I was impressed by the pervasive nature of and importance of immigration. And I think that whatever the special position of the Alaska Natives is, or whatever the position of any other group is, they cannot be determined one by one. There must be some kind of what I call a delicate balance.
David Case and then Bishop DeRue.
Two words that you said piqued my curiosity in this question. I think it goes to something Hugh Brody was touching on, only from another angle. To what extent, I wonder, does Las Casas's view of rights and his ideals presume that by the phrase you use, peaceful persuasion, the Native American cultures would in fact be changed and thereby developed and eventually assimilated into what perhaps even Las Casas viewed as a better culture? Is that also part of, or consistent with, Las Casas's views on the rights of the Indies?
I don't think he'd use the phrase better culture. I do know that when someone charged him with supporting a doctrine that should not be supported, namely peaceful preaching alone, when some Spanish, I think Dominicans, were killed by Indians in Florida in the 16th century, they said, look, this is what happens. Peaceful preaching? Your brothers are killed. Is that what you support? And his answer was yes. I don't know whether he said that the blood of martyrs is something which produces Christians. I don't know. But